From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When she was 10 years old, Julia Alvarez went from being part of the privileged class to being a minority, a result of her family moving from the Dominican Republic to the United States. On this edition of Fresh Air, Julia Alvarez on her new semi-autobiographical novel, How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents. Also today, we continue our discussion on human rights in post-war Kuwait with Ken Roth, the Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews four of today's top hits. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Tens of thousands of supporters of Boris Yeltsin gathered near the Kremlin for a rally in support of the candidate for the presidency of the Russian Republic. The BBC's Bridget Kendall reports from Moscow.
In what has become a pattern for these central Moscow rallies, Boris Yeltsin himself was absent, ending his last whistle-stop campaign tour of his home city of Sverdlovsk. Among those present was another of Wednesday's candidates, Yeltsin's colleague in the Democratic opposition and head of Moscow's city council, Gavril Popov. He's also seeking to boost his popular mandate by being directly elected as mayor of Moscow. Another Yeltsin colleague, leader of the Democratic Party, Nikolai Travkin, told the crowd they were perhaps meeting like this for the last time. Up till now, he said, our attitude to those who sit in the Kremlin has always been critical. But Mr. Travkin said that after these elections, Mr. Yeltsin and his supporters would be able to move from criticism to deeds to implement the radical reforms they wanted for Russia.
The BBC's Bridget Kendall in Moscow. Iraq has asked the United Nations for a 5-year moratorium on the payment of reparations for damages caused by the Persian Gulf War. The request came in a letter from Iraq's UN ambassador, Abdul Amir al-Anbari. Al-Anbari pointed out that the UN embargo on Iraqi exports is still in place, and Iraq's funds overseas are still frozen. He also challenged an estimate by the UN Secretary General, Javier Perez de Cuellar. The secretary had calculated that Iraq would be able to pay a maximum of 30% of its oil revenues in reparations. Al-Anbari said the amount would be far less than that. The Supreme Court has agreed to decide whether it's constitutional for local governments to prosecute people for displaying symbols such as Nazi swastikas or burning crosses. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In agreeing to use a Minnesota cross burning as a test case, the Supreme Court has set the stage for what could be its most important First Amendment decision since its ruling 2 years ago upholding the right to burn the American flag as a political protest. The case the court accepted for review involves a challenge to a St. Paul, Minnesota ordinance that bans the placing on private property, including presumably one's own private property, of any symbol, such as a swastika or a burning cross, which arouses anger, alarm, or resentment on the basis of race, color, creed, religion, or gender. The law was used to prosecute a 17-year-old St. Paul youth after he and a friend were arrested for burning a cross on the lawn of a black neighbor. He challenged the cross-burning ordinance in court, claiming it is so broad that it bans conduct that's protected by the First Amendment guarantee to freedom of expression. Now the Supreme Court will decide, probably not until next year. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost just over a point to close at 2,975.4. This is NPR News. A Canadian man was sentenced today to 10 years in prison for his part in a bombing that killed 2 airport workers in Japan. Indurjit Singh Rayat was found guilty last month of helping to make a bomb that was to have been put aboard an Air India flight in Tokyo. Instead, the bomb went off early, killing 2 Japanese baggage handlers. Rayat is a member of the Sikh religion, and the bombing is believed to have been a terrorist attack in support of Sikh independence in India. 1 hour after the Tokyo explosion, an Air India flight blew up over the Atlantic Ocean off Ireland, killing all 329 people aboard. 6 living in Canada have been accused of that bombing. An amusement park near Cincinnati is not releasing details of 2 separate accidents that killed 3 people this weekend. Lorna Jordan of member station WVXU has the story.
A spokeswoman for Kings Island Park says no determination will be made about the two accidents until experts can examine the situation. Electrical specialists are being called in to inspect the pond in which two men were electrocuted and died. A third man was injured in the incident Sunday night. In an unrelated accident, a Toledo woman was killed when she fell from a ride. State inspectors and a representative from the Swiss manufacturer of the ride will meet later this week to discuss the second accident. The state of Ohio says the ride involved in the fatality had passed all safety inspections. A spokeswoman for the agency overseeing rides, the Ohio Department of Agriculture, says the park has a good overall accident record. The park remains open, but the ride in question has been closed. For National Public Radio, I'm Lorna Jordan in Cincinnati.
Sources close to the investigation of the assassination of former Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi say that a senior Tamil rebel leader is among the prime suspects. Gandhi was killed in an apparent suicide bombing last month at a political rally in southern India. Tamil rebels have been suspected. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Julia Alvarez, was born into a prosperous, privileged family in the Dominican Republic. But when she was 10, Julia emigrated with her family to the United States and became a minority, a New York Hispanic. She and her three sisters became teenagers American style, swept up in the rebelliousness and sexual openness of the late 60s. It was all pretty shocking to their parents, who left the Dominican Republic to get away from the dictator Trujillo. Alvarez has written a semi-autobiographical novel about four sisters from the Dominican Republic who come of age in the States. It's called How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents. Alvarez lives in Vermont now, where she teaches at Middlebury College. Before we talk about Alvarez's life, here's a reading from How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents.
This is from Daughter of Invention, and it's one of the stories about Yo-Yo, the third oldest, who becomes a writer, and she is asked to give the Teacher's Day address at school, and she can't think of what kind of a speech to write. And finally, she reads some Whitman, and she gets very inspired. She reads the lines, especially, "I celebrate myself and sing myself. The best student learns to destroy the teacher." And so she writes the speech that's a little bit off the beaten track. I mean, she's not being as grateful to teachers as she should. So she reads this to her parents in the bedroom and waits to be praised. And, of course, her father hears the speech, and he doesn't like it at all. And his name is Carlos in the passage that I'm going to read. So he hears the speech, and he says, "What is wrong with her speech?" Carlos wagged his head at her. His anger was always more frightening in his broken English, as if he had mutilated the language in his fury, and now there was nothing to stand between them and his raw, dumb anger. "What is wrong? I will tell you what is wrong. It show no gratitude. It is boastful. I celebrate myself. The best student learns to destroy the teacher," he mocked Yo-Yo's plagiarized words. "That is insubordinate. It is improper. It is disrespecting of her teachers." In his anger, he had forgotten his fear of lurking spies. Each wrong he voiced was a decibel higher than the last outrage. Finally, he shouted at Yo-Yo, "As your father, I forbid you to make that a speech." He leapt from the bed, throwing off his covers. The Spanish newspapers flew across the room. He snatched the speech out of Yo-Yo's hands, held it before the girl's wide eyes, a vengeful, mad look in his own, and then once, twice, three, four, countless times, he tore the speech into shreds. Probably, if Yo-Yo had thought a moment about it, she would not have done what she did next. She would have realized her father had lost brothers and friends to the dictator Trujillo. For the rest of his life, he would be haunted by blood in the streets and late-night disappearances. Even after all these years, he cringed if a black Volkswagen passed him on the street. He feared anyone in uniform, the meter maid giving out parking tickets, a museum guard approaching to tell him not to get too close to his favorite Goya. Yo-Yo gathered a handful of scraps, stood up, and hurled them in his face. In a low, ugly whisper, she pronounced Trujillo's hated nickname, "Chapita. You're just another Chapita."
Julia Alvarez, did anything like this ever happen to you, that you wrote something and read it to your father and He had this really surprising reaction.
Well, it's funny because I make up so much in terms of the fictional characters that sometimes I lose a sense of what is made up and what really happened. I do remember a speech that my father forbid me to give because it was kind of, it was sort of the first speech, as I say in this story, in which I found myself in English, in which I sounded like myself in English. And it was kind of spunky and not really sort of the conventional little praising of teacher speech. And I remember that he forbid me to give that speech at school. But it didn't evolve the way that this story evolves. Because, of course, I wanted to push it further in the story and find out what happens when you hurl these two worlds together, the new American world that Yo-Yo is entering, and the old world, and the police state, and the terror that the father still lives in. Yeah.
Were you ever embarrassed by them, by their opinions, by their clothes, by their language, when you were young?
Well, I think when you're a teenager and you're embarrassed by yourself, your whole body feels like it's the wrong size and the wrong everything. I was embarrassed by the fact that that my friends wouldn't understand my father when he spoke because he had a heavy accent, that we talked too loud. I remember we lived in a building in New York City and they complained that our food smelled. And I felt this, I had been the way we were back in the Dominican Republic, we were just like everybody else. And all of a sudden, the sense that there's something different about us. And I didn't have the good luck of living in a comunidad where there were other Dominicans. And I could say, hey, this is the way we are. I thought maybe something is wrong with us.
Yeah, well, you're in the position of having gone from being in your country to suddenly being what we call a minority. And that you must have felt that difference.
Well, it was, it's strange because as you know from the book, part of what I'm writing about is coming from the old country, being from a sort of well-to-do family, being part of the majority, and all of a sudden thrust into a world where you are the minority, where you don't really belong, and you feel at odds with what's going on. And I think that's the experience that drove me to be a writer. I always say that I would never have been a writer in Spanish. What made me a writer? I'm not a born writer. I wasn't born wanting to be a writer or having that desire for the solitude and the interior life of a writer. But coming to this country, and all of a sudden losing a culture, a homeland, a language, a family, it's sort of, I wanted a portable homeland. And that's what the imagination, the world of the imagination is. So I think in a way, becoming a so-called minority is what really drove me to language and to words and to the imagination.
Do you think having come from a prosperous family,
right,
that you had a different sense of being a, quote, minority than people who grew up as a, quote, minority in the United States, where they'd never experienced being part of the majority, where they'd never experienced being privileged?
Well, I think in some ways it was also, becoming a minority was also good for me because I developed a social conscience. I think it was there growing up because you can't live in a third world country, a so-called third world country, and see the difference between those who have and those who don't have, and not be somehow affected by it and not want to do something about it. But maybe you grow unconscious about it if you live there, for the rest of your life or whatever. But I think coming to this country gave me a social conscience in a way that I wouldn't have had before because I saw what it meant to be on the other side, And I also, reading books and going to school and going to, being in the in college during the 60s, you develop a social conscience then too. So I think it really, it was a mixed and bittersweet experience to be an immigrant in this country.
Why did your family leave the Dominican Republic?
Why did they leave? Well, it was, of course, in the book it's exaggerated, but it was because of political reasons. We had a dictatorship for 31 years. Trujillo, whose nickname was Chapita. And
what does Chapita mean?
I don't know what it means. I think probably some Dominicanos out there know what it means. It's one of those you know, hated nicknames that he had. And, you know, I'm not quite sure what it means, but that's how you referred to him. And we were living in the Dominican Republic, and my father was involved in the underground against Trujillo. And so we were lucky that we got out, you know, before something happened, before he got arrested or killed.
Growing up, were you afraid of the secret police? And did you carry that fear with you when you came to the United States?
It's funny because, you know, now I look back and I talk this over with my sisters. Did we know things? You know, because, of course, my parents never spoke. And I remember different incidents, which then didn't quite make sense. There was just an atmosphere of cautiousness. I remember that I had a pen pal in the United States, and my parents were very afraid because, of course, the mail was all red and censored about what I would write. And my mother insisted that she read the letters before I wrote to this pen pal in the United States. And, you know, my English was, dear Sarah, how are you? I am fine. Goodbye. You know, that was it. But she was afraid that I would say something. And so little things like that, that now I say, aha, I see what was going on. I remember my parents looking out the windows and saying, are they there? Are they there? Because it turned out later that for a period, my father was under a kind of surveillance, and the black Volkswagens would come up the driveway. And I said, who are there? And something was told to me, oh, guests that are coming, or your tía is coming over. So I didn't know. But now I say, aha, that's what was going on. But I'm sure we all lived with a sense of, you know, sort of subliminal anxiety, because the grown-ups were terrified.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Julia Alvarez, and her new novel is called How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Writer Julia Alvarez is my guest. When you moved to the States, did a lot of the girls your age have no idea what or where the Dominican Republic was?
Absolutely. I remember that they would call it Dominique or down there. And all kinds of questions about, you know, do you eat stuff like this there? You know, there were ignorant questions, but they were... Some of them were well-meaning questions, curiosity, because I was the only immigrant in my class. That was not, I didn't come with a wave of immigrants. There weren't a lot of other Dominicanas or even Puerto Ricanas or anybody in the class but myself, and in the other classes, my sisters. So there was curiosity, and there was a little bit of ostracism, or, you know, hard times because we were different and we didn't know the language, we didn't dress like everyone else, and we had accents.
When you got to college, did it almost become hip in a way to be Latina? You know, because there were revolutionary movements in Latin America, and you were genuinely from a third world background. You know what I mean?
Exactly. That was very strange to all of a sudden, for it to be popular to be who I was. And, I just remember even the look. You know, I don't know if you remember late 60s, 70s, the peasant blouses, the hoop earrings, the clothes from Mexico, the sarapes and so forth. And all of a sudden, there were people trying to look like us. And that was a strange experience, to suddenly be popular for what had been at first the source of name calling and ostracism and so forth, to suddenly be a popular thing to be. And it gives you a sense of perspective, too, about image building and so forth. You really do have to carry who you are inside you. and not depend on it out there necessarily from the mainstream culture to define you.
I'm wondering if in the late 60s, some people who you'd meet in college, for instance, would say when they met you, would just assume that you were an authentic expression of the oppressed poor of the third world, and they'd be disappointed to find that you were actually from early privileged background.
I know that's, again, you know, the image building, you know, that just the stereotyping. If you are, you know, from a third world country, then you are, you're an oppressed minority. And I felt almost as though I was getting credit for something that I wasn't. And I had to sort of re-educate people about myself. And also, in some ways, it also made me feel guilty about my own privileges, because I felt that, gosh, you know, I didn't feel like the right kind of Latina, you know, that happened. And it's still, you know, coming from a privileged background, coming from a family that could give me things, it's still a burden. I mean, it really... Especially now as I get older, I see it as a real responsibility. I mean, I'm still hunting in my own head what it is that I want to do to give back some of the privileges that I had.
One of the things one of the characters has to deal with in your novel is certain differences, certain kind of sexist habits of the father. For instance, when this sister gives birth to a son, and it's the first son in a couple of generations,
right,
she already has a daughter, right? But her father comes, and he's so thrilled to have a grandson, and he's whispering to the grandson about how he can be president because he's an American citizen, and
yeah,
this son's really going to grow up and be something. And the mother of the son is standing there thinking, well, he never said this to my daughter. My daughter's standing right here. My daughter's hearing this. And, you know, she's very upset at the way her father's playing favorites.
Right, right.
With his grandson over,
yeah,
his granddaughter. Have you had to deal with things like that? You know, things that you would now interpret as sexist that seem perfectly acceptable in the culture that you're from?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think part of the reason that America was... North America coming to the United States was liberated me in some ways into thinking that as a woman I could do things, which I don't think I would have thought I could do, especially from my background and in my family. Women just didn't do those things. But at the same time, because my father, not my fictional father, but my real father, didn't have any sons, each one of us, of his daughters, at one point or another became his son, quote unquote, his son. And so in a way, a kind of sexism that might have happened if there were a son, a real son in the family, didn't happen because we were just daughters.
Was there a turning point in your life where you felt that you needed to stand up to your father's authority because there were things he believed that you didn't believe, or there was a way you wanted to live your life that went counter to what he wished for you, and you had to stand up for what you believed in no matter how much it would hurt him?
Well, I'll tell you, I think that one of the things that made it easier for me, I was the one that was the writer, the bohemian. So in a way, it gave me a certain amount of license. I think actually writing is one of the ways that has been hard for me in terms of, my parents understanding that I'm a writer and that I have these stories to tell, and that sometimes they're not the stories that they would want for me to tell.
Oh, sure.
You know,
yeah.
That's been for me a way that to stand up and say, I have these stories to tell. I have to be true to my experience. Sometimes they'll say, but why do you have to publish that? You know, why do you have to? People will think that we, you know, that it's about us, or people will say certain things. And that has been what's been hard for me to claim. And it's something that I've talked to other writers about, and particularly other writers, ethnic writers. You know, you think of Maxine Hong Kingston, How Woman Warrior Begins. My mother told me never, ever to repeat this story. And the story starts. you know, this mandate of silence, of, you know, we keep things among ourselves. We don't go out there and you know, like those Americans, they get on talk shows and tell everybody their stuff. You know, and the thing that you have to explain is that it is fiction, that you're not trying to, you know, tell family secrets or whatever, that you're making things up. And that if people think it's about your family, you just have to say, you know, they're made up. You know, the configurations are very similar, but they're made up things. They're, you know, they're lies, as my mother would say. You know, you lie to tell the truth as a writer.
That impulse to not tell in your family probably has a lot to do with the secret police and fear of like things getting out. And also with the fear of being thought of as being different because you're in a culture where everybody's different from you are.
Right, right. I mean, the excerpt that we read at the beginning of the program where Yo-Yo experiences censorship from her father. I mean, at the end of the story, the father and she have reconcile, and the father says, your father, he just want to protect you. And there's that impulse of, you know, don't tell the secrets because the secret police are outside the door and ready to nab you. And even though you know that it's not true, there's that sense of secrecy, of having to be careful what you say, of looking over your shoulder. So I think that persists, yeah, that kind of censorship. And also, yes, the censorship of being in another culture, in another world. And, you know, you keep your things to yourself, entre familia. You don't go out there and yak to here I am yakking at strangers, you know. And so it for them to understand that I'm a writer and that I'll write certain things and that the characters in my stories might you know have an affair and do things that just nice girls don't do is hard sometimes for them to understand, you know.
Your novel's called How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents. Do you think of yourself as having completely lost your accent, and is that something that you think is desirable?
It's funny because I'll think, well, you know, I sound very American, and then my students will say that there's a lilt to the way I talk, or that I mispronounce or pronounce a word in a strange way. I don't think it's necessarily a desirable thing to lose your accent, But in this book, what I'm talking about is the other losses that come from losing your accent, from having, you know, sort of coming into America and losing the old world and the culture and the family there. Of course, you don't lose the culture and the family. That's what the girls in the book discover, that, you know, they have each other and they never lose that. But losing the accent is to me kind of a metaphor for other losses that happen when you come into America.
Julia Alvarez, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Julia Alvarez is the author of the new novel, How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents. It's published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. I'm Terry Gross, and just a reminder that on the next Fresh Air, we'll remember Stan Getz, the great tenor saxophonist who died last week. We'll rebroadcast an interview I recorded with Getz 1 year ago.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, human rights in post-war Kuwait. Ken Roth is the deputy director of Human Rights Watch. Last week, he returned from a 9-day trip to Kuwait, where he found Kuwaitis violating the rights of minorities. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews 4 summer hits. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. New York City police say as many as 4.5 million people witnessed today's ticker tape parade as it moved up Lower Broadway's Canyon of Heroes. Don Matheson of member station WNYC reports.
It was a day of unbridled patriotism. Millions of people cheered the troops of the Persian Gulf War as they marched in the largest ticker tape parade in memory. 24,000 marchers plowed through tons of paper. At times, the parade had to be halted so sanitation workers with brooms could clear a path. The parade is over, but the celebrating continues. Veterans groups are sponsoring a party for the troops aboard a retired aircraft carrier berthed in New York Harbor, and tonight, it's fireworks over the East River. Police report 36 anti-war protesters have been arrested. They staged a demonstration near City Hall, and some of the protesters scuffled with parade celebrants. For National Public Radio, I'm Don Matheson in New York.
The Supreme Court will hear a Minnesota case and decide how far communities can go to fight hate crimes. The case involves a St. Paul teenager who was charged with burning 2 crosses in the front yard of a black family last June. The youth was prosecuted under a city ordinance, which makes it a misdemeanor to put a burning cross or a swastika on public or private property, even if it's one's own property. It's also a crime if it arouses anger or alarm in others on the basis of race, color, religion, or gender. The teen's lawyer says the ordinance is too vague and overbroad. The British Foreign Secretary, Douglas Hurd, has said Britain will invite President Gorbachev to London after the Group of Seven summit ends next month. Janet Berry reports from London.
Douglas Hurd's announcement today comes after weeks of negotiation between leaders of the 7 leading industrial nations. Gorbachev had hoped for an invitation to the summit to plead the case for more Western aid for the Soviet Union. The United States and Britain last week dropped their objections to Gorbachev attending the meeting, but said he should not expect immediate financial assistance. Accepting his Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo last week, President Gorbachev suggested his economic reform program could fail if the West did not respond to his appeals. Douglas Hurd said Gorbachev would be given a sympathetic hearing when he comes to London. He added that the Western nations would cooperate in planning the Soviet Union's transition to a market-led economy. For National Public Radio, this is Janet Barry in London.
The State Department says Secretary James Baker and Israeli Foreign Minister David Levy may meet this week in Washington to talk about progress in a Mideast peace conference. This would be the pair's first face-to-face meeting since Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir rejected proposals from President Bush, which sought to bridge peace differences between Israel and Syria. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said that Levy is traveling to New York tomorrow on a private visit and may come down to Washington. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower. The Dow lost 1.34 points to close at 2975.40. This is NPR. The Albanian Communist Party opened its party congress today, deeply divided over their future. They're split over the legacy of late Stalinist dictator Enver Hoxha, who ruled Albania for 41 years. Some officials blame Hoxha for the country's economic problems and isolation from the rest of the world. There are reports that the Albanian party could split. A general strike by Albania's independent trade unions dealt a crippling blow to the ruling communists. The government resigned on June 3rd and will be replaced by an interim multi-party government until new elections are held next May. Iraqi Kurdish leader Jalal Talabani claims that the United Nations has no interest in protecting the Kurdish people from Saddam Hussein's government. The Kurdish leader made an appeal in Istanbul for the continued presence of large numbers of troops in northern Iraq until Kurdish leaders reach an agreement with Baghdad. Jonathan Rugman filed this report for the BBC.
Mr. Talabani, talking to journalists, seemed to be a man on the lookout for new international guarantees for the safety of his people. either because the current guarantees are not strong enough or they're about to expire. He repeated his claim that there was work for Allied forces to do in Iraq beyond their humanitarian mission of saving lives, and he said that the troops shouldn't leave Iraq until a settlement in Baghdad was forthcoming. He said the Iraqis insisted on enshrining the dictatorial role of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party in their constitution, and there were territorial differences, particularly over the oil-rich city of Kirkuk. Mr. Talabani suggested that if the United Nations could not resolve to guarantee the safety of the Kurds, then perhaps the European community could make Iraq guarantee to respect United Nations resolutions.
Jonathan Rugman in Istanbul. A Canadian judge has sentenced a Sikh man to 10 years in prison for helping to kill two Japanese baggage handlers in a bomb explosion at Tokyo's Narita Airport. Inderjit Singh Riyat was found guilty of two charges of manslaughter. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The U.S. ambassador to Kuwait made a speech in Kuwait over the weekend in which he addressed the trials of alleged collaborators now underway there. He called for Kuwaitis to champion justice and fairness in the same way the entire world stood for those principles for Kuwaitis. Most of those standing trial are Palestinians, Iraqis, and Bedouin, people who have lived in Kuwait sometimes for generations but who are not recognized as citizens. On Saturday, a Bedouin man who had served in the Kuwaiti Air Force was sentenced to death by a martial law court for collaborating with the Iraqis. Ken Roth, deputy director of the human rights group Human Rights Watch, returned last week from a 9-day mission to Kuwait. On the last Fresh Air, we discussed the trials he monitored. Today, in part two of our talk, other reports of human rights abuses. While Roth was in Kuwait, the emir announced that elections would be held in October of 1992, an announcement that disappointed members of the pro-democracy movement.
Most of them had been hoping that early 1992 would be the date chosen, and they continue to press for a revision of the emir's statement in this regard. It's worth noting that at the same time as this late date for elections was announced, the government extended martial law for an additional month, the fourth consecutive month now since liberation. And the reason cited for that was the ongoing lawlessness in Kuwait. What we found was that this lawlessness was not the sort of random private violence that the Kuwaiti government and, in fact, the U.S. Embassy often portrays it as being, but rather that the principal problem in Kuwait today is violence organized by Kuwaiti security forces. And this type of organized torture and, in many instances, killing was not at all addressed during the first 3 months of martial law. The Crown Prince, in announcing the extension of martial law, made a very important acknowledgement in that he noted for the first time the problem of mistreatment in police custody and vowed to prosecute those responsible, even his own son, he mentioned, should that be necessary. That was a very important acknowledgement and a very important pledge. It remains to be seen whether the Kuwaiti government will live up to it. One place where we've urged them to concentrate their attention in the first instance is a series of mass graves that we were able to discover in the Al Riga Cemetery on the southern outskirts of Kuwait City. And there are roughly 20 graves there that are clearly fresh graves, graves that were dug since liberation. When we looked at the registry that the gravediggers kept, the registry noted not only when various bodies were buried, but also the date of death in many instances based on hospital records that had been brought to the cemetery, since all bodies have to arrive at the cemetery via one of the hospital morgues. And by looking at those records, we were able to count 54 unidentified bodies who had died since liberation, in fact, since March 6th, that is to say, a full week after liberation and after the height of the private vengeance, the very emotional violence that took place just after liberation. If the Crown Prince is sincere in his pledge to put an end to this sort of violence, one very important place to begin is with those mass graves at the Al Riga Cemetery. It's as a matter of justice, as a matter of telling those families of the victims what has happened to their loved ones, and as a matter of preventing this sort of violence in the future and preventing the deep emotions in Kuwait from breaking out into some sort of civil war, it is absolutely critical that the Crown Prince carry forth his pledge, get to the bottom of these graves, and prosecute those who are responsible for these killings.
The ruling family of Kuwait has banned all opposition political activity in the country. Do you have any idea what's happening in the opposition behind the scenes now?
The opposition is actually quite active behind the scenes. In fact, just this past Tuesday, the opposition organized its first form of public demonstration. It was very much a demonstration, Kuwaiti style, in that everybody met at a mosque and basically sat around and talked. The opposition, which at this stage ranges on the one hand from Islamic fundamentalists to, on the other hand, secular liberals, is united really only on the question of early elections. They differ on virtually everything else, be it extending the right to vote beyond the so-called first-class Kuwaitis, of whom there are roughly 50,000, to the other 600,000 or so second-class Kuwaitis who do not have the right to vote. They're divided on whether women should vote. And they are not publicly speaking out at all about the violence that is facing particularly the Palestinian community, let alone talking about the problems of the Badoon.
My guest is Ken Roth, Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Ken Roth is my guest, Deputy Director of the human rights group Human Rights Watch, and he just returned to the United States after spending 9 days in Kuwait. In the 9 days that you were in Kuwait, did you try to go off the beaten track and see what you could investigate and discover on your own?
Well, we were, it's worth stressing, always on our own. We were not accompanied by government officials. We had entered Kuwait with official permission, but we were never followed as far as I know, and certainly we're not constrained in any way as to who we could meet other than fear of simply endangering the people who we would want to encounter. But we very much ventured into particularly the Badoon and the Palestinian community. We had more difficulty trying to enter the small and quite beleaguered Iraqi community in Kuwait at this stage, although I was able to speak with some long-term Iraqi residents of Kuwait. But we were quite able to get into the various non-Kuwaiti communities in Kuwait City. And I think we're able to get a fairly clear picture of the serious problems they are encountering. For example, if one walks into Hawali, one of the principal Palestinian areas, one's immediately struck by the garbage piled all over the street, because while garbage collection has been resumed in many of the Kuwaiti sections of Kuwait City, it has not occurred at all in the in Hawali or the various Palestinian districts. One sees these sorts of lines drawn within Kuwait City wherever you go. If you look at the license plates on the cars, you recognize that the Kuwaiti citizens all now have Kuwaiti license plates, either because they were able to quickly exchange their Iraqi license plates after liberation, or they were able to hide their cars in their villas during occupation and thus never had to take the Iraqi license plate in the first place. In the Palestinian community, many of the people don't dare use the Iraqi license plate at this stage. That can be quite dangerous. But they also have been unable to secure new Kuwaiti license plates. The Palestinians noted to us that they don't live in villas, that they live in apartment complexes, and they had to park their cars on the street. And so most of them did have to take Iraqi license plates during the occupation. Their inability to get new Kuwaiti license plates means that they can't use their car without risking very substantial fines, as well as possible harassment and beatings at the checkpoints if they go out and use their cars. So this is yet another factor that leads many Palestinians to be just sitting at home without any possibility of employment, quickly losing whatever savings they had accumulated, and they are really becoming desperate.
Was there a moment of your trip that you found to be an emotional turning point for you, or something that was more surprising than anything else during your trip?
I was struck by the radical disjunction between the various communities in Kuwait. I, on the one hand, was surprised by the the normality that existed within the Kuwaiti society. While many of the stores, particularly in the downtown area, continue to be burned out or standing in rubble, life is going on at a relatively normal level for many Kuwaiti nationals. And that normality struck me. But for that normality to be existing side by side with the quite troubling picture that I saw in places like Hawali, the Palestinian district, and for these communities not even really being able to talk to each other or not being willing to talk to each other, that disjunction was moving to me in an extremely troubling way, particularly since I and the few foreign journalists who were there were often the only link between these communities. The Kuwaitis were simply not extending themselves to, say, the Palestinians, and the Palestinians were much too afraid to extend themselves in the opposite direction. And that distrust and divide in what, in the end, is a tiny little country, some 2 million people before the invasion, is something that was really saddening and is perhaps the greatest long-term casualty of the Iraqi invasion.
You're about to testify before Congress. Can you give us a sense of the message you want to give Congress about what you think the United States' role should be now in the rebuilding of Kuwait?
Well, it is clear that the United States has tremendous influence over the Kuwaiti government. This is one of the few instances when we can really say that the U.S. government has created this foreign government. It has made it possible for the emir to return to the throne. And as a result, the United States has a quite special responsibility to make sure that the government that it has put in power is one that, at the most basic level, is respectful of human rights. So what we would urge the Bush administration to do, as well as those in Congress who can be heard, is to make clear that it is simply unacceptable for the sort of violence now taking place, the sort of extreme discrimination taking place in Kuwait, to continue. The U.S. has been reluctant to speak out on this issue. There have been occasional forays, although, as I understand it, President Bush has still not said the D word, democracy, in his public statements. The Margaret Tutwiler, the State Department spokeswoman, the other day when asked about the mass graves in the Al Riga Cemetery, tried to say that, oh, they're nothing new. You know, there's really nothing of concern there, although I'm happy to say that the State Department has made inquiries of me since then, and so it may be that they're beginning to move and appreciate the significance of these graves and of the killings that they represent. But so far, it's almost as if the administration does not want to tarnish the glow of Desert Storm, and that anything that suggests that the government that it put into place in Kuwait is anything less than perfect might somehow come back and cost the administration politically in its efforts to defend the repulsion of the Iraqi invasion. I would hope that those sorts of political considerations can be overcome and that the administration can recognize that it has a legal and moral duty to do something about the violence and discrimination in Kuwait and to speak out forcefully and publicly in an effort to structure a democratic society that is respectful of the most basic human rights.
Ken Roth, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Ken Roth is Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch. He testifies before Congress tomorrow. Fresh air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on the Desert Storm Parade in New York?
Oh, we'll have a report from New York where the ticker tape parade is happening. Also a talk with an anti-war activist about what she makes of these various celebrations. A talk with defense correspondent Molly Moore of the Washington Post about the inter-service rivalries that were really at work during Operation Desert Storm, despite the signs of so much of inter-service fraternity that we see nowadays in the parades. Also, news of the volcano in the Philippines, fears of floods in Iowa, and we'll also be hearing about how Ethiopian Jews are getting used to life in Israel.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Usually our rock critic Ken Tucker reviews albums, but lately he's been listening to some singles on the pop charts. He says most of the time, the songs go by on the radio with no mention of the singer, no background on the song. So Ken did a little homework, and here's his analysis of four of the top singles.
The biggest surprise to hit number one so far this year has been Amy Grant, who until now was known primarily as a performer of glossy, middle-of-the-road ballads that seemed to owe their inspiration in equal parts to James Taylor and God. Over the past decade, Grant has been one of the most well-known performers of the sort of pop gospel that stresses born-again religiosity in its lyrics and proceeds from the assumption that a loud guitar line is a venial sin. Grant has always seemed more open-minded than that, and the result of such free thinking is Baby Baby. As much as she's attempting and succeeding in cracking the secular music charts, Grant is also trying like the devil, as it were, to keep from alienating her core constituency. As such, she's been doing interviews saying that Baby Baby is not, as you might guess from that song, a tune about a lover. No, Grant says it was written for her young child. Now, I was always raised to believe that the pleasures of the flesh aren't exactly antithetical to the pleasures of faith. I feel badly for Grant, who feels compelled to go around downplaying her success and apologizing in advance for making a sexy piece of music. Not apologizing at all, on the other hand, is Christina Amphlett, lead singer for the Australian band The Divinyls. Their hit single, I Touch Myself, is so ostentatiously bold that their crassness comes to seem witty, and Amphlett's smoky vocal emerges from a knowing smile. As a piece of music, I think I Touch Myself is clever and irresistible, but it's also a song that's nearly destroyed by its stupid video. The Divinyls have been struggling to make it in America for nearly a decade, and when it came time to film some eye-catching visuals for MTV, they weren't taking any chances. Whereas Christina Amphlett had previously prided herself on a disheveled, punk urchin look, the I Touch Myself video finds her poured into a tight dress, pushing her cleavage into the camera. It's a desperately cynical move that undermines a good song. My favorite rhythm and blues single of the moment is from a young vocal group called High Five. It's a silly yet utterly beguiling song with a heavenly falsetto chorus. Listen for it on I Like the Way, which is subtitled The Kissing Game.
Awesome. You threw me back when you smiled.
But now you say you're tired of mere pop music. You wish you could hear something more serious, something with more depth. Well then, what you want to hear is the only hit single around these days that's based on 6th century Gregorian chants and the work of the Marquis de Sade. That song is called Sadness. Not sadness, sadness. Summoning up a bored English tone of voice as well as de Sade, and for all I know, freshly shoveled Sade. The song is ascribed to an act called Enigma, but it's just one more pretension by the real creator of this music, producer Michael Cretu. Maybe he and Amy Grant should team up and collaborate on a follow-up hit. Gee, do you think they'd call it Godness?
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Ajiva Blytus, Joyce Lieberman, and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon is back in the director's seat after returning from his honeymoon. Welcome back, Chris. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, we remember Stan Getz. He died last week at the age of 64. We'll feature an interview recorded 1 year ago in which Getz discussed his life in jazz, from his days as a teenager on the road with Jack Teagarden to his battle against cancer. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
$1,200.